Welcome back to the U.S. Naval History Podcast. This episode is part two of three, where we discuss the South China Sea and the maritime challenges that the U.S. Navy, and really the whole world, is facing in that region. This particular episode is about China's shadow maritime militia that they employ in the South China Sea, and the other gray zone tactics that China is using to push their sovereignty claims both in the South China Sea and in the rest of the world. Since the mid-2010s or so, the PRC, the People's Republic of China, has been expanding its maritime militia, which is a force nominally engaged in commercial fishing, but it's not really, as I'll explain later. The maritime militia, in fact, operates hand in glove with Chinese law enforcement, slash the PLAN, which is the People's Liberation Army Navy, and the Chinese Coast Guard, to help China achieve its military and political ends in the South China Sea, by operating in a legally ambiguous gray zone to push around other players in the area. Here's a quick recap of the history, but if you want a more in-depth version, go back and listen to the previous episode on the history of the South China Sea. But in short, the South China Sea is one of the world's most contested and important waterways. In the South China Sea, we've seen that China's claims tend to evolve to fit whatever is politically expedient at the moment. Going back to World War II, the Japanese had occupied the Spratly and the Paracel Islands, which are the two main island chains in the South China Sea. In 1945, the Japanese had been defeated and the French, who had previously controlled those islands as part of their Indochina colony, and the Chinese both scrambled to occupy the islands that the Japanese had withdrawn from. It was basically free land. The thing is, though, that there is absolutely zero Chinese legitimate claim to these islands. No Chinese soldier or sailor ever stepped foot on the Spratly Islands until 1946 or so, and this post-World War II island scramble. But now that the Chinese had a tenuous foothold on the Spratlys, they went back and started looking for some more solid justification to their claim. And long story short, there wasn't any, but what they did come up with and decided to present to the world was a map from 1936. This map had been made by taking a bunch of old Royal Navy sailing charts and drawing a dashed line around the bunch of islands and saying that any islands in here, inside these nine dashed lines, belongs to China now. Those nine dashed lines encompass almost all of the South China Sea. And China has since added a 10th line that includes Taiwan, because they forgot about that originally. But these 9/10 dashed lines, which encompass Taiwan and the South China Sea, are the basis of the Chinese claim to that region. The Chinese also rely on some dubious historic claims that the Chinese had extensively explored the region, and that Chinese fishermen had been fishing in it for thousands of years, all of which is very dubiously and inconsistently true. And if that is the basis for a territorial claim, then a whole lot of other countries have a better claim on the area than China does. But at the time, and for the next few decades, China was pretty happy to have these nine dashed lines serve as a vague claim, because the Chinese didn't really have any way to enforce any sort of claim, even if they had wanted to. But as the decades roll on, and in the 90s, China starts to grow, we, the United States, had lifted our embargo. Under Deng Xiaoping, the economy had liberalized and let in a controlled form of capitalism, and the economy started to do really well, and the government at that point started looking abroad to claim some of the economic and the legal rights over the seabed and the airspace and the waters of the South China Sea. In part due to the really rich oil and gas deposits in the region, and in part due to the very ecologically rich fisheries there, and in part because the region is strategically located. If China controls the area, it would not only serve as a great defensive buffer against seaborne threat, but it's also a weapon against the Japanese, the Taiwanese, and the South Korean economies, which rely on trade going through the South China Sea region. And all of this eventually led China to claim the entire South China Sea as their own exclusive economic zone, meaning only they have the economic rights to the gas, the fish, the sea life, everything else that goes on in there. And in 1998, China announced that it claimed everything inside that nine dashed lines, the sea, the airspace, the islands. It was now part of their national boundary, not just a claim on the islands. And at this point, the United States starts to take more of an interest and notice, because the United States Navy is the ultimate guarantor, although by no means the exclusive guarantor, of the freedom of the seas, which is a common good. We can't just abide by an extremely excessive maritime claim. We can't do nothing and thereby tactically acknowledge China suddenly claiming rights 1,000 miles from its shore, which is 5 times farther than the legal limit. If we allow the second biggest country to do this, then it has pretty bad knock-on effects on international rule of law and other countries' feelings of its applicability to them. A final ruling in 2016 invalidated the Chinese claims to its, quote, historical rights inside the Nine-Dash Line, which stretches almost 1,200 miles south of the Chinese mainland and encompasses more than 80% of the South China Sea. China has since announced that it rejects and will not abide by the ruling of the international tribunal that, at least in theory, it agreed to be bound by. And so over the next decades, and continuing until today, China has essentially embarked in a salami-slicing strategy, meaning that they're doing a little bit more, a little bit more, a little bit more, and operating in a constant gray zone, while the United States has worked, you know, a bit naively and ineffectively up until recently, to counter this influence. But in the meantime, the Chinese have taken from other countries by force and then built up these tiny coral atolls and sea features into full-fledged military bases with radars and missiles and airstrips and barracks and port facilities and all of the necessary military might for a fight in the South China Sea in the event of a new Pacific War. And conveniently enough, these bases also serve as a great staging ground and supply depot for a very deniable maritime militia. And for the United States, what matters in the South China Sea is the dispute over the maritime rights and ensuring that international law is followed. These issues are separate from the disputes over the islands. Who owns this island or who owns that island doesn't involve the United States. There are international dispute resolution procedures for this sort of thing. The U.S. interest, and our interest for more than a century, has been focused on the freedom of the seas and ensuring that international law is observed. When there's a dispute, the dispute goes through various courts and arbitration panels to solve these sorts of things in a rules-based order, as opposed to relying on a might-is-right military force. And the United States is committed to ensuring that the rules-based international order is followed because it's good for trade, it's good for global common prosperity, and it avoids wars in the long term because war is bad, right? And for a long time, the United States has had a lot of allies in the area. We had South Vietnam, we had the Philippines, and we still have those relationships today. But the worrying thing about China's activities over the past decade plus, as they've been developing this maritime gray zone militia, has been the fact that it's relying on non-military coercion, slowly eating away at the rules-based international order in a manner that's pretty difficult for the U.S. and our allies and our partners to respond to, precisely because of the gray nature of these gray zone tactics. The South China Sea is a huge part of the greater Chinese Communist Party strategy, which goes back more than 20 years at this point. And it is a very intentional use of infrastructure and military development in that gray zone. The Belt and Road Initiative, which is the marquee global Chinese infrastructure development program, is just the next iteration of that. It's just the next iteration of that combination of civil-military fusion, using the military aspect with the commercial aspect, with these deniable aspects, and pushing in a coherent national security direction. And China has proved themselves to be very adept at this. You can see this at the South China Sea, where China has used this below the level of armed conflict, staying just short of our red line strategy to change and reshape the facts on the ground in the South China Sea region. And they're trying to move away from a multilateral framework and towards a bilateral framework where they are the dominant country, because when it's China versus pretty much any other country in the South China Sea region, they're the big dog. They are much more powerful militarily. They are economic giants. They are more powerful diplomatically. They have a larger population. And one-on-one, China can dominate these countries when the system is not rules-based and instead a bilateral us versus them might makes right sort of relationship. And this is, again, the centerpiece of their strategy. The key aspect of this salami slicing strategy is that it's really deniable and yet ultimately very aggressive and successful over the course of several years. Instead of calling in the Navy and the Marines, the Chinese use a massive maritime militia to belligerently and flagrantly violate other nations' sovereignty and other nations' economic rights in the South China Sea. Part of this economic conflict is the absolute ecological destruction that China has wrought on the South China Sea, which used to be and to a much lesser extent still is today, one of the greatest and most biologically diverse areas of the world. And the destruction is sickening. The South China Sea ecosystem had more than 600 coral reef species, more than 3,000 fish species, more than 1,500 species of sea sponge, has giant clams and all sorts of aquatic life. And the same ecosystem, it supports fisheries that were the traditional livelihood of thousands of communities all along the rim of the South China Sea. Just in 2016, there were 16.6 million tons of catch. And all of this is supported by coral reefs and the islands themselves, with their mangrove forests and seagrass and turtle populations, and tens of millions of seabirds, which use the islands as breeding and wintering homes. But the economic degradation that China has unleashed on the South China Sea is purposeful and has two purposes. The first is that China views the South China Sea as a purely adversarial arena and through an adversarial lens, and not as a resource to be managed, unlike almost every other country that has a stake in their exclusive economic zone. You don't want to fish your area to death and kill the goose that laid the golden egg, so to speak. But the Chinese know that it's not really their area, and so exploit away, right? Short-term it. The Chinese fishing fleet is by far the worst perpetrator of illegal, unreporting, and unregulated fishing in the world. And this is not limited to the South China Sea. It's often aimed at poor countries in Africa and South America, which don't have their own resources to protect their economic rights. And this huge and totally unregulated scope of the fishing fleet devastates fisheries all over the world, and there is no internal Chinese government attempt to regulate it or to stop the fleet from violating other countries' rights or using the most ecologically destructive methods available. Nowhere is this more apparent than the South China Sea. China takes a maximally adversarial approach to the South China Sea and has unleashed a hugely subsidized fishing fleet there because they see themselves in a zero-sum game with the other claimants of the South China Sea. The fishing fleet is sometimes directed in a retaliatory way against countries which have annoyed China in some manner. And how that happens is a concentrated fleet of subsidized Chinese fishing boats will descend directly off the shoreline of a country that has offended China in some way and just fish that region to death. The Chinese fishing boats will just surround and harass and push out the local fishing vessels. They will dredge the coral. They'll cut the coral up for fish and giant clams, and they'll leave a maritime equivalent of a desert where there had previously been a thriving ecosystem. But the local fishermen, they can't push back because A, there's not as many of them, but B, because to do so would be all of the justification that the Chinese military needs to send in an armed and reinforced patrol, which of course at that point is just protecting the rights of the poor Chinese fishermen against the aggression of their hostile neighbors, or, you know, something like that. Sometimes, though, the coercion is even more direct, and the intermediate step of an excuse is not needed for the maritime militia to act. For example, after the 2016 ruling, which firmly established that China's 9/10-line map was invalid, and it did not, in fact, confer to China the right to 80% of the South China Sea, Vietnam, which is another South China Sea claimant, was the most vocal country in the region when it came to pushing back against Chinese claims. And immediately afterwards, Vietnam hosted the aircraft carrier USS Theodore Roosevelt at Da Nang as a show of support and as a very visible signal that the United States and Vietnam would be partners in the region. And so at that point, China got mad and therefore got especially aggressive. Their maritime militia boats rammed Vietnamese fishing boats. They used their huge underwater cannons to overwhelm the onboard pumps that the Vietnamese fishing boats had, caused them to flood, and ultimately they sunk at least one of the Vietnamese fishing boats off Woody Island. And Woody Island, if you remember, is the largest island in the disputed Paracel Island chain, which is that northern group of islands in the South China Sea, and it's claimed by both Vietnam and by China. China, though, has effective control over most of that island chain, and has built up a small city known as Sansha City in support of the claim on Woody Island, and has steadily added more and more military hardware to the island, including HQ-9 surface-to-air missile systems, runways that have hosted People's Liberation Army Air Force fighters and long-range bombers on them, and it serves as a major headquarters and supply depot for the state-controlled Sansha City Corporation, which runs many of the maritime militia units in the region. And so when Vietnamese fishing captain Tran Hong Tho anchored his fishing boat near Woody Island, the maritime militia responded by spraying water cans at his ship before eventually slamming into the boat, sinking it. And all this is recorded from a bunch of routine cameras on board the captain's fishing vessel, and I can honestly say that it is terrifying. The Chinese vessel that rams the Vietnamese fishing boat is much bigger, and it very clearly picks up a lot of speed to essentially slice the Vietnamese fishing boat in half. You can see the water rushing into the hold from the interior cameras and the screams of the fishermen. It is, I can tell you, genuinely scary, and I would not have wanted to be on that boat. And here's a brief news clip of Captain Tho. Which is translated as, they returned and rammed into the left side of the cabin, near the large door. My boat tilted and it was about to capsize. The boat eventually did sink, and the livelihood of Tho and his men, which depended on this boat, was destroyed. But importantly for the Chinese, a signal of be afraid was sent to every Vietnamese fisherman who might think about fishing in what is rightfully the Vietnamese exclusive economic zone. The thing is, though, that this is not an atypical interaction. The same pattern of floodings and rammings by maritime militia boats with reinforced hulls has been practiced again and again and again against Vietnamese, Filipino, Malaysian fishing fleets all across the South China Sea. And those countries' fishermen are afraid, and rightfully so. This level of bullying and environmental destruction has not attracted the attention, though, that it should have. Just the artificial island building alone is hugely environmentally destructive and is destroying huge amounts of coral and dumping cement by the millions of tons into the South China Sea to build these artificial islands, and that's a travesty. And yet, you don't hear much about this from the usual environmentalists. And there's a couple reasons for this. Perhaps there's some degree of ideological alignment, since a lot of these environmental groups are somewhat left-leaning and perhaps sympathetic to the Chinese system, but a far larger aspect of it revolves around China not making it easy to get records and information on this sort of thing. But also, China's an authoritarian system, and so these environmental groups know that they're not going to budge the Chinese, right? And God knows if the United States was doing something similar, these groups would be protesting left and right, you'd never hear the end of it. But against the Chinese, they've been largely silent because the Chinese government is just not responsive, but also has a lot of ways to put pressure on these groups. The Chinese government indirectly and discreetly funds these groups, and if the environmental groups don't toe the line, the funding, it's just going to go away. This has not only minimized criticism of China, but the funds that these groups get also serve to hamper the United States. For example, the United States might like to build a new port facility somewhere, but we have to deal with the environmental consequences. We make it harder and slower and more expensive, and sometimes just scuttles the project altogether. All of this is just an aspect of the same game, where China is playing in that gray zone and winning the salami slicing war against us by taking a little bit here, a little bit there, a little bit there, in pursuit of regional dominance. And because of this, it is imperative that the United States not fall into the Chinese trap of framing the South China Sea as a bilateral issue. It is not a China-US issue. It has never been. It is a dispute between China and its neighbors, between China and the global commons, between China and the very rules that China itself has agreed to. China, Vietnam, and Taiwan all have claims to the Paracel Islands. You have China, Taiwan, Vietnam, the Philippines, Malaysia, Brunei, at least claiming parts of the Spratly Islands, and then you have Indonesia claiming part of the seabed and the airspace. And again, it's not for the United States to dictate who gets what piece of land. The United States doesn't have a dog in this fight. The United States' interest is making sure that everybody is bound by international law. And that's what makes Chinese claims so stinking problematic, with their directly opposed stance. There's a reason that when the Philippines won that 2016 final arbitration victory against China, that they were able to rally 56 countries immediately who said that they were supporting the ruling and condemning the Chinese claim, because these claims go against the very heart of the rules-based international order. China can't claim 1,000 miles of water when international law says every country gets 200. If two countries are less than 400 miles apart, you split the maritime rights down the middle. Simple. That's how it's supposed to work. And for the record, the United States doesn't exclusively enforce these rules against China. The United States has freedom of navigation operations against dozens of countries on a regular basis. I'm going to talk a lot more about these in the next episode, but we do them against Vietnam, we do them against India, we do them against Malaysia, every country in this region has had a FONOPS conducted against them. Because we conduct free of navigation operations on any country where we determine that they are claiming something that they aren't entitled to. Because only through these freedom of navigation operations is the United States able to enforce the rules-based international order by saying, no, we don't accept your invalid claim. So going back to the maritime militia, China operates this way in the South China Sea and does not put their big official PLAN gray hull ships, no aircraft carriers, no destroyers down there for the most part. They send in a spectrum of maritime militia. Some of them truly are fishermen. Some are technically employees of state-owned corporations, but not officially affiliated with the military. Some of them are in a quasi-militarized Coast Guard. But at the end of the day, all of this is in service to Beijing, which is trying to warp international law to work the way that domestic law works in China, which is as a tool of power, not as a restraint on power. To the Chinese international lawyers who argue for the validity of China's 9/10 line map, they know that it's BS, quite frankly. They're not making a great argument, but that's not the point. The rules are supposed to adapt to what China wants. China is a big, powerful country, reclaiming its rightful place at the center of the world. And China is not supposed to adapt, in their minds, to what the international law says. And these are, by the way, the same laws that China in the 70s and the 80s helped negotiate and agree to. The same laws that they were big supporters of at the time, because it helped China enforce its own claims on its actually rightful territorial waters. Because at the time, they had no Blue Water Navy. They had no Coast Guard. They had no maritime militia. They'd barely even seen the Spratly Islands. The ships that they did have were listing and broken. They couldn't get underway consistently. It was a broken, dysfunctional country, still recovering from the horror of the Mao years, and caught between the great powers of the world on every side. But then, slowly, as China began to modernize its navy over the course of the 80s, the 90s, the 2000s, they began to develop a real Blue Water Navy. And now the Chinese have the world's biggest navy, complete with aircraft carriers and a very large, in fact, the world's largest shipbuilding industry, the world's largest offshore oil and gas industry, this huge survey fleet. And so now, these same rules that China agreed to don't work so well for China anymore. Now the rules are constraining China. And so for the Chinese Communist Party, these rules just shouldn't apply, or the rules should change to fit the new reality that China's the big dog. This isn't only seen in the maritime domain, it's seen in all aspects of international law. There's this dichotomy of international law now on display, where China wants international law to apply in areas where it is weak, and the United States is strong, such as North America, South America, Europe. But they want a different set of laws to apply, or not to apply in this case, where China is strong, so close to home in Asia and parts of Africa, because there, they can get that one-on-one bilateral relationship and bully other countries. And again, you see this again and again and again in lots of areas of international law. China has definitely noticed where our red lines are. That's invading other countries, say Kuwait. We don't stand for that. So to get around this, they have adopted strategies they have believed, correctly, would not trigger an armed response from the United States. And that's that salami slicing thing again, where they dilute and delude and hide the ownership of the maritime militia, which start out as regular fishing vessels. And these were just super low freeboard, not particularly robust, not complex commercial vessels. At the beginning, manned by true fishermen, who were sort of given a task by the government, they were paid for it. But now it's coalesced into more than 200 quasi-warships equipped with water cannons, these big ramming bumpers, very strong engines, reinforced hulls, and military-issue communications equipment. And so it's turned into what is very clearly an orchestrated military operation. Sailors aboard these ships no longer fish. They are a combination of former fishermen and PLAN veterans who train as military members. They wear a variant of the digital camouflage uniform that the United States Navy and the regular PLAN do. It's a, again, a complex quasi-military operation, but legally, technically, just part of a state-owned company and not a branch of the military. And that is largely how China has been able to stay under the threshold of awareness with these gray zone activities in the South China Sea. And when we're talking about militia, I just want to be crystal clear that this is not figurative language. This is a clearly defined entity within the Chinese system. It is state-supported. There's military equipment on board. It is used and directed by the government. They are not just fishermen who occasionally do some weekend reserve duty and run supplies down to the Spratlys. This is the definition of military-civil fusion. The maritime militia activity began on a large scale in the 80s, when China started subsidizing these originally true fishermen to go operate down the Spratly Islands, where they'd largely never operated before, and then over by Scarborough Shoal, where again, there's no evidence of Chinese commercial fishing post-World War II, until the government started paying them to do that. At this point, these paramilitaries are still mostly commercial fishermen, just paid by the government to work in a certain area. But slowly, the integration is ramped up, and the fishermen got experience working alongside the PLAN and the precursor to the Chinese Coast Guard, and they essentially began bullying other countries' ships and would conduct these mass coordinated actions against other ships. And then over the next 20, 30 years, going to today, there's been a sea change in how these guys operate. The sea change, though, has been most explicitly linked to the number one guy in China, which is Xi Jinping's rise. When Xi Jinping was vice president, these maritime militias were not professionalized to the degree that they are today. But it was this maritime militia that took over Scarborough Shoal for the Chinese in 2012, which established de facto control over the reef, taking it from the Philippines. And this reef was the foundation, now built with a lot of concrete, of what is now a much larger island with a military base on it, right up against the main Philippine islands. At the time, Xi Jinping was vice president, just on the cusp of his ascendance to party chairman and president. And in that summer of 2012, he made this big speech about the Chinese dream and about rejuvenating the Chinese nation. And as part of the Chinese dream, China was going to become a great maritime power. And it was going to use maritime power as a tool for asserting China's greatness on the world stage. Because Xi had correctly read the lesson of history. Going back to Alfred Thayer Mahan, who laid all this out in The Influence of Sea Power Upon History. To be a powerful nation, you need a powerful navy. Because otherwise, you're just going to get pushed around in the international stage. And a navy is the only way to project force over great distances. Xi saw this and made it the core part of Chinese political ideology in his reign. That China would press its territorial claims, and especially with regard to Taiwan and the South China Sea. But also in other various border areas with India and Vietnam. And a big part of Xi Jinping's political legitimacy is wrapped up in these promises to the party and to the people. And to do that, China would need a modern military to enable them to reclaim all of this territory. Of course, whether it's a legitimate claim is obviously another question, but while remodernizing the military, Xi also directed the modernization of the militia starting around 2013-ish until today. You can draw a straight line from the speeches early in Xi's reign calling for uncompromising assertion of territorial rights to today, where you have 1,000 boats that are professional militia in the South China Sea. And there's a much larger component of less professional militia behind this 1,000 boats that are still actual fishermen. But these 1,000 boats, they don't fish anymore. They are professional militia members who've largely displaced the old fishing villages in Hainan. They've been brought under the control of this state-owned company. And technically, it is a company, not part of the military, but it's the Sunshine Fisheries Development Company, based in Sanchao City, on the island of Hainan, which is a big southern island just off the coast of the Chinese mainland. These guys get their salaries paid for by the government. There's a very explicit PLAN veteran recruiting program. They have their boats built by the government, maintained by the government. They wear these digital camouflage uniforms. They train with the PLAN. They train with the Coast Guard. They are an arm of the state. And they need to be treated as such. But then behind that 1,000 boats, you have the bigger fleet of less professional, but nonetheless very heavily subsidized militia called the Spratly Backbone Fishing Fleet. These guys are newer, and they're mainly out of Guangdong, which is a very rich, very densely populated area around Hong Kong. They're not as directly state-owned, but they're called upon in a time of need. These guys get a huge subsidy to operate as a militia down the Spratlys, where they're paid for the amount of time that they spend in key strategic areas. And so that's why if you were to sail a ship up into the Spratlys, you can see hundreds of ships with skeleton crews just drop anchor somewhere and hang out and collect their check for 6-8 months at a time. They're tying up to these reefs, not really doing anything. They're just directing a little bit of harassment towards the Filipino and Vietnamese and relaying information back up to the PLAN. But when necessary, they can drive off fishermen from other countries And in the past, they forced back Vietnamese and Malaysian oil exploration and drilling platforms from the Vietnamese and Malaysian exclusive economic zones to make way for the Chinese platforms. And all of it's, you know, it's pretty successful because you can pay a bunch of guys to do something that's not economically productive. And how do you counter that? Well, it's difficult. Do you shoot a bunch of these patriotic fishermen and invite a diplomatic firestorm from China and give the Chinese Navy the excuse they're looking for? Or do you not push back and accept the Chinese bullying? It's a hard question. And I don't have the answer. But China has more strategies in its belt, and one is called the Port Park Strategy, as in a business park around a port. And the way it works is this, where first the Chinese government and a state-owned company, with the backing of a state-owned bank, goes and secures a seaport or an airport in a strategic location. And they build that port, but all the work is done by Chinese contractors. And these Chinese contractors exclusively bring in Chinese citizens to do the work and operate and maintain that port afterwards. But of course, this new port requires a very large industrial base because obviously you need to support the new infrastructure, and these development deals are not being struck with rich industrialized countries. And so now you have a large population base living there and you need somewhere for them to live. So you build apartment blocks and condos. And now you have a small Chinese city, and all this is negotiated ahead of time. Yeah, that the Chinese have this little piece of land that's sort of contracted out. But the Chinese also build into the water to avoid angering the locals quite so much. And this all happens in strategic areas, say the South China Sea and beyond. But as I said, there's now this small Chinese city behind the port park, and you have tens of thousands of Chinese citizens living in this greater industrial area. But still, there's no one in uniform. They're just regular civilians doing their job that they found on whatever the Chinese equivalent of LinkedIn is. But now, since China has developed some land jutting out into the ocean, they maybe have a claim to an exclusive economic zone. Not legally, but they will say that they do, around this area. And they start undermining the sovereignty of the partner nation that initially let them build the port. It's the same process, by the way, with the artificial islands that they're building on the reefs. But now, China has this economic interest because they're claiming an exclusive economic zone. And thus now they have a military interest. And by the way, they have lots of their citizens there that need to be protected. So the very last step is to send some guy in uniform in the military to show up and say, hey, we're just here to protect our legitimate security and exclusive economic zone interests, or the special economic zone interest that was granted by, you know, pick a country. And this infrastructure, by the way, is all backed up by these very long 99-year leases, where page 178 have a thing about, if you don't pay us back or you default on this loan, it becomes a sovereign territory of the People's Republic of China, aka it's going to become a military base, and the Chinese can do whatever they want with it. And so there's this public opinion manipulation in the countries. There's a lot of bribery involved in getting these deals through. There's a lot of coercion involved. But China's been very effective at doing this throughout the world. And they've done it not just in the South China Sea. They've done this thing called the String of Pearl strategy surrounding India. And India has become awake to this, and they're trying to counter it to the extent they can. But again, that gray zone salami slicing strategy, it is civil military fusion directed towards a coherent national security claim. And historically, the United States has not been particularly effective at countering and working with other people up until this point. The Chinese Belt and Road Initiative is the same thing, where China sees itself as the dominant maritime and commercial and economic power in the world, and is predatorily coercing countries to take on this debt load that they know other countries cannot pay, and then they take over the port facility. And meanwhile, these facilities don't employ a single person from Djibouti or whatever. They employ all Chinese citizens. And so all these Chinese companies, which are getting money from the Chinese government via the state-owned bank, who gives the money to Djibouti, who is contractually obligated to pay it all to the Chinese contractor who built this port and operated it, they know they're just going to take it away. And all this is, again, facilitated by a lot of alcohol, bribes, the MSS, which is the Chinese equivalent of the CIA, all this facilitated behind the scenes. And so as a result, China now has a nice overseas military base in Djibouti and a bunch of others probably in the works. Not an ideal situation. And the same thing is happening in the South China Sea. This is a huge concern for the United States, and we're still working on how to respond to it. A large part of it is freedom of navigation operations, which I'm going to delve into in part 3, the final part of the South China Sea miniseries that you're listening to now. In part three, I'm going to drill down into a little more international law. Hopefully you find that interesting. But really, the Navy's response in the form of FONOPS. You heard a taste of it at the end of the last episode where I played some tape from a U.S. Navy plane flying over one of China's artificial reefs and the Chinese ground station there. I'll play another one at the end of this episode really quick, but really it's just some crackly radio back and forth to give you a preview. This use of the maritime militia, the use of these gray zone deals are the equivalent of the little green men that Russia used to take Crimea. If you remember back in Crimea, Russia used special forces soldiers, which didn't have Russia insignia on them. They just drove into Crimea one night in 2014 and took over before anyone could figure out what was going on. And Crimea became de facto Russian territory, and Putin took that as no one's pushing back against me, and look where we are in Ukraine now. And that same Crimea situation is happening in slow motion in the South China Sea now, and other areas of the world. The South China Sea is just the forefront. China is taking this approach because they want to avoid an outright confrontation with the United States. But there are some other reasons why they're taking the gray zone approach, and partly it's just because it's cheap. It's a cheap way to extend the reach of the People's Liberation Army Navy. The South China Sea is huge. You can't have a Chinese destroyer everywhere. Destroyers are expensive. So this militia, though, they can be everywhere. It's a couple grand a day for a fishing vessel. Whatever, you can afford that all day, every day. And the effects are the same as if a destroyer was there. And that professional maritime militia, the ones wearing the uniform, they're put on escort missions for Chinese survey vessels. They go harass Malaysian and Vietnamese and Filipino oil drilling platforms and drive them back. They drive away the economic activity of other countries. They escort these highly illegal fishing fleets, which go on to devastate the exclusive economic zones of other countries, dredging for clams, destroying the coral, fishing the area to death, even really close to these countries' shores. I mean, it's, you know, truly devastating the livelihood of other countries and done in an intentionally antagonistic and yet deniable way. That's sad. All in pursuit of establishing a one-on-one bilateral relationship that they can dominate in. And it's been pretty effective. We've been insufficiently able to push back against this as a country, but we're ramping it up, and that is the next episode. We are countering the destruction and the coercion on the part of the maritime militia and these illegal claims that the militia is attempting to make the reality on the ground for the neighboring countries. Because you can't just open fire on these militias. When you kill a bunch of Chinese fishermen, the Chinese newspapers, the broadcasters are going to say, oh, you've hurt the feelings of the Chinese people. And when you hear that from Chinese state-owned media, you know that you're about to hear a bunch of BS. If you read in a Chinese newspaper or government statement that you've hurt the feelings of the Chinese people, or the feelings of the Chinese people are offended, then you know you're about to hear the party line, shall we say. And so you can't just do that. You have to be smart about what you do. And all these play into the legal status of the militia force and stopping China from achieving its goal, which they're very close to doing, of securing de facto control over all peacetime activity in the South China Sea. That's fishing, or the right to overflight, or oil and gas exploration, or peacetime transit. If you get to the point where the United States Navy is the only one sailing in the South China Sea, China has already won. Because at that point, our allies and our partners are going to look around and say, what the heck, man? We supported you and your mission to ensure that the rules-based maritime order was being followed. For decades, we supported you. The United States Navy were unable to bring the muscle to bear to counterbalance its Chinese influence. And so that's the next episode. It is the muscle that we are bringing to bear to counter the Chinese influence in the South China Sea. The episode is going to be released in 2 weeks. There's a lot to be excited about. It's FONOPS and the increasing efforts under the Biden and the Trump and the Obama administrations to push back against these very assertive Chinese claims, against the maritime militias, against the island building campaigns, against the egregious economic claims that have no bearing on international law, to try and secure a rules-based international order and ultimately make the world more secure for all of the players. So thank you very much. I hope you enjoyed this. If you feel so inclined and you enjoyed the show, please go leave me a review. Subscribe if you haven't subscribed already, because again, these episodes come out fairly inconsistently. If, say, next week I've got a big project at work, it's going to be longer, and then you'll get the next episode in your sleep. So also tell your friends, post it on your social media page, Facebook, Instagram, whatever, YouTube channel. I'd greatly appreciate you helping me spread the word. Until then, fair winds and following seas.